Hello and welcome to Technically Legal. This is podcast 48 for May 4th, 2010. I'm Dominic Rabi, and with me today are
Ben Snickoff,
David Liu,
and David O'Brien.
We've got three great stories for you this week. First, we're going to be talking about the Supreme Court granting cert on the California violent video games case. Next, we'll talk about a class action case over Sony removing third-party operating system support from the PS3, and we'll wrap up with the one record equals one statutory damages award. So we'll start with our first story, which is the Supreme Court has granted cert in the California violent video games case. A little bit of background: in 2005, California passed a statute that basically mandated labeling of violent video games. It defined a violent video game as a video game where the range of options available to the player included killing, maiming, dismembering, or sexually assaulting an image of a human being. It basically said that you can't sell these sort of video games to minors, and it has to be labeled with this solid white 18 outlined in black that'll be on the front face of the package and has to be at least 2 inches by 2 inches in size. It based this statute on the Californian interest in preventing violent, aggressive, and antisocial behavior and preventing psychological and neurological harm to minors who play violent video games. The bill itself found and declared that exposing minors to depictions of violence would reduce activity in the frontal lobes of the brain, I'm quoting the bill itself, and even for those minors who weren't more violent, it would somehow harm them. So the the Entertainment Software Association and the Video Software Dealers Association filed a lawsuit in California before this bill came into effect that basically said, wait, stop, you can't do this. Our video games, first of all, this is content-based discrimination of speech. And second of all, we are already labeling our games voluntarily because the ESRB has its own little voluntary rating system. But most importantly, you're violating our First Amendment rights by imposing this content-based labeling system. So we want to stop this law from going live, effectively. The Ninth Circuit agreed with them, and recently, the reason we're talking about this story is because the Supreme Court has granted cert, as it's more commonly known, and they are going to review the Ninth Circuit's opinion. So, fellow members of Technically Legal, thoughts on this case? I think that summarizes pretty much.
Yeah, one interesting thing is that apparently the Supreme Court was holding off whether or not to grant cert in this case until they decided the recent case of United States versus Stevens. In that case, that had to deal with depictions, any depiction of cruelty to animals. And that statute was struck down as being too broad. Essentially, what happened with that statute was it was drafted to prevent one very specific type of depiction of cruelty to animal, but the way the statute was drafted, it theoretically could have made it illegal to sell a hunting magazine in Washington, D.C., where hunting is illegal, totally forbidden. So, you know, since that case was resolved, and it was resolved, I believe the decision was something like 8-1. I think Alito was the only justice who dissented in that case. Because that got resolved, the Supreme Court then finally, you know, acted on this pending case, which had been pending, whether or not to grant certiorari, it had been pending for a very long time, unusually long for the court. What do people think of the merits of this case, though? So, you know, right now it's on track to be argued probably sometime in the first half of next term, sometime between October and January. Do we think that the state of California really has a case here? I mean, the Supreme Court takes a very dim view to any type of law that regulates speech, and in this case, it, you know, clearly does.
Well, it's kind of hard to say. I mean, there are a lot of other states that do have very similar statutes, as far as I know. Traditionally, when you have these types of statutes, they have to be very well defined and limited in terms of their scope and breadth. So I think one of the biggest questions that is going to go before the Supreme Court is whether or not the statute is actually constructed in such a way.
I think more in legal terms, it's whether or not the statute is overbroad or whether or not it's ambiguous in, you know, what it actually defines. Here, I think one of the biggest problems that the state of California is going to run up against is that the way that they defined violence was taking a page out of the obscenity definition. And it's obscenity is a type of speech that it, well, it's not speech, according to the Supreme Court. It's a type of communication that isn't protected under the First Amendment. And that has a very specific legal definition. And essentially what California did, take the definition of obscenity as it applies to sexual conduct and sexual content and try to apply it to violence, you know, whether or not it was patently offensive to, you know, a group of people, particularly in the standards of that community. And I think, you know, they're going to have a tough time getting the Supreme Court to essentially expand the definition of obscenity to violent things as well as things that apply to what's called the prurient interest. It's what the Supreme Court uses to describe that. Dominic, do you think that they're going to have any luck? I mean, so the one thing that the statute has going for it is that they're regulating speech specifically to minors. Do you think that's going to help them at all in this case?
Probably not, but I mean it might. But I think that the weakness of their case is such that the fact that they're trying to focus just for minors probably isn't going to help them, just because they're imposing a pretty heavy burden on non-minors, specifically the video game stores. They have to have their I mean, they could get sued for selling it to a minor, so it's not like it just affects minors.
Is there anything analogous, do you guys think, in this case that you can draw some sort of similarity to the way that the movie industry works and the rating system in the movie industry? I mean, we know that certain movies get the rating R, which excludes people, I think, under the age of 17 from seeing it in the theaters. That's not just based on sexual content. It can also be based on violence and language. So do you guys think that there's anything that's sort of similar about the statute, which just deals with the violent video games as it's defined there, and that rating system? I mean, it, also another ancillary question is there a statute which governs the movie industry that way, too?
Yeah, that's the thing. There isn't. The movie industry is entirely self-regulated, and whether or not a movie theater decides to enforce the ratings and not let somebody under 18 into an R-rated movie, that's entirely self-policed, and that's why it's constitutional. You know, there's virtually... So I should say that back in like the 1920s and 30s, this type of thing was very common. There'd be boards in each town that would preview movies and decide whether or not they're appropriate to show in that town, and, you know, give it a gold star or, you know, ban it from being shown in the town. You know, that type of thing is not constitutional, and it would not be tolerated nowadays. So the movie industry, you know, that rating system is entirely a private thing. And it's the same with the ESRB, the Video Game Rating Board. You know, they give these ratings, they're rated M for mature, but whether or not a video game store or, you know, whether or not Blockbuster, when renting out these video games, decides to enforce that rating system, is it's entirely private. And what California was trying to do is move that private enforcement into public enforcement, and that's what implicates the First Amendment. You know, if Blockbuster decides not to rent you a movie because you're under 18, that doesn't, you can't sue them because they're violating your First Amendment rights. You know, that's an entirely private action. One of the requirements for a violation of the Constitution is, you know, it's called state action, but in this case it can be either the state or federal government or even a local government that does that. You just need the government being involved.
Right. Now, as I understand it, in this case, the Ninth Circuit decided that, standard of review purposes, that strict scrutiny applied here, which generally means that you have to have, when you have a statute that's restricting speech in this way, there must be a compelling government interest that's narrowly tailored in the least restrictive means possible that won't sort of sweep in too much permissible speech that would otherwise fall under free speech than other stuff like the obscenity, which doesn't qualify. Now, the Ninth Circuit seems to also say that there wasn't a compelling government interest here. I didn't really get a chance to read the opinion too closely, but did you guys get a feel for what the grounds were on that?
Compelling government interests have been fairly narrowly defined by the Supreme Court. There are things like preventing corruption. That's a compelling interest. But protecting minors from abstract harms like this, it's a tough call. Courts are very reluctant to. Dominic, sorry, were you chiming in?
Yeah, the Ninth Circuit basically, as they say that, sure, the state might have an interest in, I mean, there is a state interest in preventing actual and psychological and neurological harm, but that interest doesn't extend so far as to control the thoughts of minors. They basically say that the effect of video games on minors, they don't think that that evidence is strong enough to say that it makes for a compelling state interest. In other words, they're saying that the state has relied on this one doctor, Dr. Craig Anderson, who has done a lot of research in this area, and they rely pretty much only on his research to say that violent video games somehow harm minors. And the court is basically saying that's not enough, isn't something that is, and specifically they say that there's flaws in his research, and there isn't a causal, there's just not sufficient evidence to establish a quote causal link between violence in video games and psychological harm. So they're saying the science just isn't there, and secondly, even if the science were, even if there were a compelling state interest, it isn't meeting the narrowly tailored test.
Right. And obviously, like what is probably going on here, at least for the public debate, you've got a bunch of studies out there which basically don't really draw conclusions when you put them all together. I mean, some studies will say, look, we have all this evidence here that violent video games definitely harm the minds of children, and then there's these other studies which say, no, that's not the case at all. We find that these video games don't even harm them in the least bit, so it's not something to worry about. So it makes it a little bit more difficult, I think, for the court to decide one way or another what might qualify as a compelling government interest in those cases. And frankly, I'm not very surprised that a court would sort of say, like, there just isn't enough to make this compelling.
All right, any other last thoughts on this story?
I'd like to chime in. My last thought would be that they're going to have a tough time with the narrow tailoring because, depending on what exactly the procedure that California set up for age verification, this is the kind of statute that could have an adverse effect on non-minors getting access to these video games too. And the Supreme Court tends to look down on things that have, sweep in more speech or, sweep in a broader area than the statute intends. And the Supreme Court would look down on, and very much so, on anything that would make it harder for adults to get totally legal content.
All right. Our next story, David Liu is going to introduce. So, David?
So now we turn from one of the video game industry's large markets, i.e., kids, to, I guess, one of the smaller markets, which is people who are technically savvy enough to install other operating systems on their video game devices. So the PS3, one of the so-called seventh generation platforms, was very attractive for the fact that at least they were advertising it as a full multimedia platform. So Sony really pushed the idea that they had, Blu-ray and this other capability of the PS3, the ability to install other operating systems on the machine, which would therefore allow you to use it as anything that you can use a normal computer for. And so they had this capability for a long while until the April 1st firmware update number 3.21, which disabled that option. And they were claiming security problems with it. Many people are speculating that this is stemming from a hacker named George Hotz, who's 20 years old, and just this past January, he announced that he had successfully hacked the PS3 so that he could have full access to the entire capabilities of the hardware. So previously, even if you installed another operating system on there, you would only have access to certain parts of the hardware. Mainly, you couldn't have access to their graphics card. So anyway, because of this, Sony released this firmware update, which disabled the other operating system capability. And that upset a lot of people because they did give you the option to not install the update and continue to use your other operating system, but that would lock you out of a lot of other PlayStation services, such as the PlayStation Network, their online content, and viewing certain Blu-ray movies, and a bunch of other key features for which you would want to have a PS3. So, a class action lawsuit was filed by.
PlayStation 3 owner filed a class action lawsuit in the Northern District of California.
Yes, thank you. Saying that this was a breach of contract and a breach of good faith and fair dealing. The plaintiff's name was Anthony Ventura. So there is this provision in the system software license agreement that is used for the PlayStation 3 that says, quote, some services may change your current settings, cause a loss of data or content, or cause some loss of functionality. And so technically, it would seem that Sony has the right to remove the install operating system feature, but the lawsuit claims that this is unconscionable. To start off, what does that mean, being unconscionable?
They're saying the lawsuit itself is unconscionable? Unconscionable? Blah.
Unconscionable.
No, that's one of the
The lawsuit is arguing
claims
that.
that the lawsuit is making, is that those claim or those provisions in the license agreement, those are unconscionable.
Just for grammatical perfection here, unconscionable, I think, is the way to pronounce it.
Thank you, unconscionable.
No problem. That's one of the classic ways to try to invalidate certain terms and license agreements. Basically, this is the classic scenario that you constantly hear lawyers or non-lawyers talking about in regard to contracts. For instance, I can't really force, or let's say that David Liu and I have a contract, and within it I sneak in some sort of provision which says, by signing this contract, I now own your soul. Whether or not you believe in a soul is really neither here nor there. But for the purposes of that contract, it's pretty likely that a court would find such a provision to be unconscionable, meaning that it's so far outside the terms that someone probably would not be able to sell it, especially if the contract subject matter had to do with other things. So that's sort of the classic example. But with regard to the Sony case, this is really about whether or not Sony could reserve those rights to take away the ability to install third-party services onto the hardware platform.
One other thing about unconscionability is that one of the other factors that goes into the determination is whether or not, well, for one, whether or not it's a contract of adhesion, something that you have to agree to if you want to proceed, either purchasing something or, it's a click-through agreement. And the other thing is the bargaining power of the two parties. If it's a arm's length transaction, just David and David here have equal levels of they were both trained in law, they're both relatively savvy consumers. Court would be less likely to find it unconscionable than if David O'Brien were a huge multinational corporation and David Liu was a schlub with a I don't want to say schlub had a, elementary school education and didn't speak much English. A contract would be much more likely to be held, or a term in a contract would be much more likely to held to be held unconscionable in the latter circumstance, where there's a big difference in bargaining power and savviness.
Right, so just to clarify really quick, what we mean by contract of adhesion is sort of like when you have almost a boilerplate agreement. Maybe it's better to say that as the person who's signing the contract, let's say you're the consumer who's buying something, you basically have no power to negotiate the terms. It's a take it or leave it proposition. So basically you have no power to negotiate against those terms if you're buying a PS3 from Sony. You have just the ability to agree to the terms and use the advice pursuant to those terms, otherwise not buy it at all. But the other interesting thing about contracts of adhesion is that over the course of time, they're more accepted these days, even though they seem to be pretty evil devices, because basically a company like Sony or whoever could insert whatever terms they would like in that agreement, especially if you have a really popular consumer electronics device like a gaming console, and you could pretty much expect that people, no matter what, if this is a really popular device, unless those terms are really, really heinous, are probably going to agree to them anyway.
There was this interesting story from a couple weeks ago where the UK gaming retailer GameStation actually inserted a clause into their contracts, I believe, that said that you grant them non-transferable option to claim your immortal soul. And, you know, it was obviously a draft and they weren't enforcing that, but I think they're trying to make a point about the ability of all these large corporations to just insert random claims into their contracts.
So, getting back to the merits, I guess, of the Sony case, you know, it's a little tough to say what the court might actually do in this circumstance, but I'm willing to bet, just based on the case law I know is out there, and that's pretty well accepted across jurisdictions, the court's probably going to side with Sony on the case, and my guess is say that the contract terms are not so far to be unconscionable. That those seem like pretty reasonable. I don't want to say reasonable terms, but even though it really, look, it's awful if you're a consumer and you're put in this position, you bought the device expecting that you would have these capabilities when you're using the device to install other things on it. But at the same time, it's pretty typical that you see contract terms which deal with the right to revoke certain types of services when you're using hardware-based things. I want to say that it's pretty common these days. I don't know that they have actually been litigated to a great extent with respect to consumer devices, though.
So one of the things that the lawsuit claims is they make reference to all of these different press releases and advertising on the box and website write-ups and different statements that company officials have made touting this feature. And so this is a clearly advertised feature, as well as the fact that, you know, it was there when they bought it. So is there something that we can say more in general about the sort of impermanence of these products? I mean, the fact that a product you own on one day with certain features might not, in fact, be the product that you'll own in a couple of years just because the company has the right to revoke some of those features.
Well, it kind of comes down to what the terms of the actual contract are that you're, you know, that's put in front of you to sign. And I really view those things that you're raising right there, David, as separate issues, because if you have a company that is marketing the device in a particular way and eventually they decide to remove that functionality that they originally marketed, you might have some sort of tenuous case or maybe a real case for something like unfair business practices or false marketing, something along those lines. But the fact of the matter is, as a consumer, you might have heard that stuff in the marketing fluff that was out there, but you also had to agree to the terms of the license once it was put in front of you. And some courts might be willing to say, like, look, you were kind of put on notice that this use of this device was all conditional on you agreeing to the terms in the license agreement. You might have been able to view those terms of the license agreement prior to purchasing the device, whether it was online or whether it was presented to you in the store. And by way of that, you should have read those terms because it's your legal duty to do that. You need to understand the terms of the contract. Now, I know this is a pretty awful point for a lot of consumers because, let's face it, the majority of consumers out there are not lawyers, and, you know, they probably don't understand or don't want to read even the legal jargon that is in a lot of these license agreements. It's pretty dense. But at the same time, you know, you do have a general duty to read them, and most courts generally do not like the argument that, like, well, yeah, I agreed to the license agreement by either clicking through or agreeing to it however the license agreement asks you to agree to it, but I didn't read them because, you know, I never read these things. They're too long. Well, that doesn't really hold because it is your legal duty to do it. So I we'll have to see, like, how the court actually deals with those types of things, but most of the cases in the past, at least in the circuit courts of appeal, especially when these things go before federal courts, the courts do seem to side mostly with the companies in terms of, like, well, if you put down the terms and there was at least reasonable notice prior to agreeing to the terms, then they're usually going to hold the person who agreed to those terms, the end user consumer, then to what those terms say.
All right. Any last thoughts on this story before we move on?
One thing that I found interesting was false business practices claim that they allege in the complaint, which is essentially that they advertised that it had these features and are now taking it out. I don't know how likely that is to succeed, if only because you can opt to continue to use it with other OSs installed. You just have reduced functionality on the PS3 side of it. I think that claim has much more weight if there are still boxes out there that come with the 3.2.1 update, but list that you can install, say on the box that you can install other operating systems.
That's an interesting point, Ben. I mean, it kind of goes back to what I'm just saying, so I'm not going to reiterate, but you might have the case there where the court just, or where the attorneys are arguing, like, look, there was the licensing terms and you had the duty to read it. So prior to then to accepting and buying the product, you were put on notice that that little bit about that functionality was actually much more conditional than you thought it was.
So apparently there were two versions of the PS3, like a really slim model that never supported installing alternate operating systems, and sort of, I guess, the not-so-slim model that did. And the guy who maintains one of the mods that lets people install Linux on the PS3 actually has an email from Sony in February of this year saying that, please be assured that Sony is committed to continue the support for previously sold models that have the install other OS feature, and that this feature will not be disabled in future firmware releases. 2 months later, the feature is disabled in a future firmware release. I'm not sure whether that rises to the level that will let this class action lawsuit prevail, because after all, it is Sony's product, and so predictions on whether this will succeed?
I'm gonna predict that Sony settles before it goes anywhere.
Huh, that's interesting. Yeah, that's a really interesting point you just made there, Dominic. And it might come down to some of the individual facts in the case, with regard to whatever classes they determine are appropriate for the class action. So it could be for some of the models. If you own some of the models which have those terms in them, then it might sort of turn on that dime that. If you bought a model which specifically stated that they were not going to remove the functionality, then that might be different than some of the other cases where they might have reserved those rights.
So I should mention the complaint does say it's the class is everybody who bought a PS3 from when they started selling them until I believe March 27th, 2010. Whether that means all PS3s or the thin versus fat ones. Not quite sure. All right.
Sure. Real quick before we move on to the next story. Just because that's the way that they want to make the class now doesn't mean that might be the ultimate class. So that sort of class actions are a complicated procedural thing in federal or in any court, really. And you have class certifications, and you have a determination by the judge then of what classes might be appropriate. So if you have a case where, say, a portion of the suit is dismissed before determining the classes themselves, or maybe even after the classes are determined, there are procedural mechanisms which might divide those classes into separate classes, I think. And Ben can feel free to correct me, since he seems to know a lot about procedural stuff, class actions.
It sounds about right. Any last thoughts on this story, guys?
All set.
Dominic.
All set.
Okay, in that case, we'll dive into our last story here. So there's a case called Bryant v. Media Rights Productions. Bryant was a guy who made two albums, 10 songs each, with one album entitled Songs for Dogs and the other album entitled Songs for Cats. The plaintiff in this case, Mr. Bryant, had established copyright registrations for each of the two albums and then some of the songs individually on those albums. He made a deal with the defendant, Media Rights, one of the two defendants, Media Rights Productions, to sell these CDs, but with the caveat that Mr. Bryant would manufacture all of the CDs, and Meteorites Productions would only sell the CDs that he himself manufactured. So they had no right to make copies of the CDs. Meteorites Production apparently screwed up somewhere and licensed another defendant named Orchard the right to digitally reproduce this album and sell it online. There were about $600 worth of sales that resulted for this. Clearly not a very popular album. The plaintiff received a small portion of that, about $300, and he was suing. He sued because these people violated the right that he granted them. The copy, part of the copyright that he granted them to sell these, but not to reproduce them either digitally or in physical form. What's interesting about this story is that Mr. Bryant went for statutory damages, and on appeal, the Second Circuit said, "You know what? Each of these is a work under each of these albums is a work under the statute, and therefore, what we're going to do is we're going to say you get one award of statutory damages per album. You don't get one award per song on the album. You don't get one award per copyright registration. You get one award of statutory damages per album." And in this case, the court awarded pretty much the statutory minimum for non-willful infringement because a judge had previously found that this was non-willful infringement. So I guess the first and obvious question here is, what implication, if any, does this have on RIAA litigation? You know, people like Joel Tenenbaum and Jamie Thomas. David, do you want to take that? David O'Brien, do you want to take that first?
Oh yeah, before we get there was a really interesting underlying contract dispute that sort of
The number.
it sort of predated this portion of the lawsuit, which had to deal with whether or not it was individual songs or the albums or the whole albums with regard to the damages. But reading out of the court's opinion here, there's a little bit of contract language that they excerpted and paraphrased, so I'm going to read this verbatim. It says here that Meteorite grants Orchard non-exclusive rights to sell, distribute, and otherwise exploit Meteorite's albums by any and all means and media, whether known or existing in the future, including throughout e-stores, including those via the internet, as well as all digital storage, download, and transmission rights, whether now known or existing in the future. So there was some dispute over what exactly that term in the agreement meant, and of course, they wanted, or Orchard wanted to argue here that that particular provision allowed them to rip those physical albums into digital copies and sell them both individually and in albums on the internet. And I think what happened is that at the district court level, the district court had determined that that particular provision didn't say anything with regard to the ability to rip those albums and make digital songs and sell those digital songs. So that was one of the key disputes here. And so that contract language sort of trumps some of these other arguments that this opinion might apply to, I think, a lot of the RIAA litigation that's been going on. Before like getting it, we get into probably some of the details of why that might be. I don't think that this opinion is really going to affect too much of the RIAA litigation and whether or not you're talking about individual songs or albums as a whole. Ben, do you know if the copyright registrations that they did, if they were for the songs themselves or was it just the albums? I got a feeling it was just the albums.
There were both, and that's why I think this is a little more interesting. So some of the songs were
Ah.
individually registered, but the albums were. So I think this is a boring case if there were just two registrations, one for each album, and only full copies of the album were made. That I think is a pretty boring fact pattern to get this result. What's more interesting here is that there were individual song registrations, but you don't get extra statutory damages if you have individual song registrations. And I think you made a good point. The reason why this doesn't really apply to the RIAA cases is you don't have, or at least we haven't seen cases where somebody is accused of infringing on multiple tracks on the same album. Normally it's one track off of each of dozens or at least several albums. So, you know, you're not going to run into this fact pattern where, you know, since you infringe two songs on the same album, you only get one statutory damage award.
Yeah, what really strikes me here is the fact that there was a contract at issue that authorized Orchard to go ahead and to sell these albums as a whole, pretty much, but only the physical media. I mean, this is just a great example of why you need to be very, very specific when you come down to the contract provisions with regard to selling these types of media. Anyone who's worked in the industry can immediately tell you that these types of contracts will often span 20 to 30, sometimes even 50 or more pages when you're talking about the rights that you're actually delegating to somebody. And I think that's what makes it really different than the RIAA cases, where you have instances of that really qualify as more outright piracy. You have people that have either bought the albums, you know, from a store, let's say, some individual, I don't want to use a college student, but that's probably the best example. Let's say it's a college student, okay? He buys an album, he rips it to his computer then, and then shares those individual songs online. That then is just a much different circumstance than here, where you have a contract which says, yeah, it's okay for you to sell these things, but we're really talking about is just the physical media itself, not the ability to rip it and make additional copies of those physical albums. And probably more importantly, not just making the copies into other physical copies, but making copies into digital copies.
Right, and we should note that this is a really weird fact pattern. You know, it's very rare for somebody to have just a distribution deal that doesn't include any right to make copies of the album. So I don't think we're likely to see this cropping up again. However, you know, Eric Goldman in his blog post, which we'll put in the show notes, makes the fair point that the notion of a work being an entire album, a work under the Copyright Act being an entire album and not just an individual song, is really kind of outmoded in today's digital society. You know, that being said, the Decemberists, a band of which I'm very fond, released an album last year, just about a year ago now, maybe a little longer, called The Hazards of Love, which was a concept album and really is best listened to start to finish as a whole. And in that case, you know, I have much less of a problem with, you know, the idea of that being a single work as opposed to each and every song, you know, being individual and severable. It makes you wonder, what if... I'm sorry, Dominic, you go
ahead. No, go ahead. It makes you wonder, what if...
You know, what if any changes are we likely to see in the Copyright Act in coming years? I mean, the last major revision was almost 25 years ago now. No, more than that, almost 30 years ago.
Well, you had the 1998 DMCA provisions, which were included.
But as far as, like, 106, you know, the bundle of rights, you know, the last revision to that was 1976, which was almost 35 years ago. It's probably about time for an update to have it more accurately reflect the current ideas behind copyright and copyright law.
Regarding the whole album and song thing, I actually ordered a CD recently because the artist BT had released an album called These Hopeful Machines, and the digital distribution only included one MP3 of all the songs in one MP3 because he wanted people not to lose the album experience. So because I want to be able to have the songs individually, I had to order the CD and then rip the CD to get the songs out. But I mean, that's one thing some artists will do, that they'll put all the songs together in one MP3 to preserve that album experience. The interesting thing about the case that we have here, to me at least, is this wasn't the world's best-selling album. Apparently in the 6 years from April 2002 to April 2008, they made $12 for selling physical albums and $600 from downloading digital copies of the songs. The plaintiffs were actually entitled to $330 of that in total, but for some reason, by mistake, the licensing company didn't pay them. They tried to settle for $3,000 in the case, but the plaintiffs rejected the settlement and said they wanted to get $1 million in damages, regardless of the $600 of revenue. So
that's a great business model right there, isn't it? Another interesting quirk that went along with what you just said, Dominic, is that the court determined that this was not willful infringement. It's something that we call innocent infringement, and that goes to the ultimate award of damages here. And if you have willful infringement, it basically shifts the statutory damages to a spectrum in between $750,000 and $150,000, and then either the court or the jury will then determine how much for each instance of infringement. But in this case, if it is innocent, the court can reduce the damages to an amount not less than $200 per instance of infringement, which is basically what they did here.
Okay. Any last thoughts on this? We'll start with you, David Liu. You've been kind of quiet throughout this story.
Yeah, sorry, internet problems. No, I'm good.
O'Brien?
No, I guess I don't really have any. I don't really think that this applies, though, to any of the RIAA litigation, at least not on its face.
Yeah, I think we're all in agreement on that. Dominic, any last thoughts?
The actual award that they got was $2,400, which was less than the settlement offer. So it kind of it's a lot of work for nothing, and they
Oh.
still have to pay their attorneys.
Not only that, you forgot about the attorney's fees they probably accrued in the process of bringing the lawsuit, so they probably lost money in that proposition.
I think they filed a something called a Rule 68 motion to try to get their attorney's fees back, but I doubt they'll be able to win that.
Yeah, probably not on innocent infringement.
Okay, in that case, I'd like to thank everyone for tuning in to this episode of Technically Legal Podcast. You can always visit us at our website, www.technicallylegal.org, or follow us on Twitter at TechLegal. If you have questions, comments, or just like to chat with us over email, you can always reach us at podcast@technicallylegal.org. So, signing off, I'm Ben Snitko.
I'm Dominic Rabier.
I'm David Liu.
And I'm David O'Brien.
Thanks for listening.